So this is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Vice Admiral Robert George, recorded on March 10th, 2014 at his home in Oak Bay, BC, by Sarah Taylor. Vice Admiral George, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. And just ask you to state your name.
Sure. So I'm Robert George. I live in Victoria, and I have lived here for the last, since 1995 when I retired. So although I'm not a native of Victoria, I married a lady from Victoria, and this is where we settled.
Okay, thank you. I'd just like to begin with some basic biographical questions. So tell me where you were born.
Okay, I was, like a lot of sailors, I was born in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. People always ask me, how come we have all these sailors from Saskatchewan? And my response is normally, it looks so appealing to somebody living on the prairies, this idea of miles and miles of peaceful ocean and cruising the world. And unlike the fellow from Newfoundland who's surrounded by the sea and has probably had to go out fishing with the family, and the last thing he wants to do is go out to sea, he ends up going to the army and staying on terra firma. So it's kind of ironic because there's a number, well, like any province, but there's a number of us from Saskatchewan and the prairies in the Navy.
Did you grow up in Prince Albert?
No, right after the war, we moved out. The family moved out to Vancouver, and I grew up in Vancouver, and that's where I first started to see the Navy. My father had been in the Air Force during the war, and I have three siblings, two brothers and a sister. I was the youngest, but for them in 1945 to move out to the West Coast from the prairies, which was it was a struggling existence on the prairies, especially if you were in the farming side. And my grandfather had come out to Canada at the turn of the century, and my mother had been born on the prairies. And I guess by 1945, they thought if we're really going to have a better future, we better go out west. And certainly the West Coast has been very kind to my whole family, and probably was one of my best moves we ever made. Not that I had much to say about it at 5 years of age, but so we started in Vancouver, and I went through school there. And I'm the only one in a family that joined the military of my siblings my age.
What was it like growing up in Vancouver around that time?
Well, the 50s actually is kind of fun because I just went to see the Buddy Holly story. I don't know whether you saw that, but that was 1956-57, and we had great years at the high school I went to, North Vancouver High, and we just celebrated our 56th, well, it was our 55th gathering, I guess, last fall of our classmates in North Van, so we still stay all in touch. We're all on a website together, and I like to keep track of where we all are and what we're doing. So it was a very positive thing. It was a great place for the outdoors. I mean, I learned to ski there, which I still do with my grandchildren, and it's on the side of the mountain, on Grouse Mountain. And all the other positive things about that period, you know, from the 60s and 70s, there was 50s, 60s, there were opportunities for putting yourself through university. You know, I didn't leave university with a huge debt or anything, or no debt at all, you know. So it was a pretty good upbringing. I had lots of friends that I still keep in touch with all around the world that ended up with careers in Africa or Australia and different places.
Okay. Well, I know you mentioned that your father was in the Air Force. Did any of the rest of your family serve in the military at all?
No, none of the brothers or sisters served in the military. And they were, in fact, I guess the oldest was, he was born in 29, so he wasn't old enough to join the military during the mm-hmm. war. And although several of their on the prairie, several of my brother's friends who were a little older had joined the forces. And in fact, one of those was probably the inspiration for my joining the Navy, because he, after the war, he was based in Esquimalt, and he used to come to Vancouver quite often, and he's quite impressive in his square rig and the way he talked and where he'd been and what he was doing. So I think that was probably one of the ideas that grew in my head about wanting to spend some time at sea.
Okay, and I know you mentioned that you married a Victoria girl. Were you in the Navy when you met her?
I certainly was, yes. I had, by that time, I had been based, I've done early training. I was based on a ship here in Victoria. And in those days, it was quite an active socially time with young people, you know, men and women, and there were always lots of contacts between the colleges and the nursing residences and the different areas that young people were in those days. So, although my wife was not a nurse, she was a banker, and but had grown up here in Victoria.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you have children as well, and grandchildren.
We have three sons who, and again, out of those three sons, one of them was interested. Actually, he was interested in the Air Force, but because of his eyesight, he wasn't able to qualify for the Air Force. But he spent several years in the Canadian Scottish and the regiments down east, because when I moved from here to Halifax in 1989, he came with us and joined the regiment down there, and they eventually served as a peacekeeper in Cyprus. So, and then after that, he got into flying school in Ontario, and then never had much more to do with the military. And the other two are both in education. One's a teacher. Well, he's now principal in Kugluktuk, which is in the Nunavut, and the other is air ambulance pilot out of Cambridge Bay in Nunavut. So they're getting their time up there in the Arctic.
Excellent. So did you have any kind of education before you entered the Navy? I know you mentioned high school.
Yes. I did. And I was thinking that I would be a school teacher as I finished high school. So I ended up going to UBC and going into science, which I really enjoyed. But somewhere along the line, I carpooled over to UBC from North Vancouver, which is where I was living at the time. And the fellow that drove the carpool had joined the Navy and was going to university as part of what we used to call the ROTP program. And in those days, that program, although there were three military colleges, there was a very large intake from universities as well. And in the case of UBC, all three services had a presence on the campus as in the ROTP program. And we would train once a week, and the Navy trained once a week down at HMCS Discovery in Stanley Park there. And so this fellow that I used to carpool started talking about the Navy, and I had said that, well, I had met at the job fair, that we used to have job fairs at the university once a year, you know, the companies would come in and talk about their working with them, and also the military would be there in numbers trying to recruit people. And I had sort of got the idea I wanted to join the Air Force under that program, the ROTP program. And my chummy said, you don't want to join the Air Force. You'll be stuck on a base, you know, someplace. He said, you want to join the Navy. They've got an aircraft carrier, and you'll be able to fly and go to sea and see a lot of the world. So I thought, this is starting to sound like a pretty good deal. And they pay your way through university if you joined up, you know. So, in fact, I applied for the Navy, and they accepted me, and I said I wanted to go into Navy Air, and so I did all the medicals and the screening for that, and I was off and running. I was in my third year at university at this stage, having gone on my own for a couple of years and paid my own way, but In my third year, I joined the Navy, and they picked up the rest of the time with a commitment of 5 years after the service, after graduation. Funnily enough, one day I was called into the commander's office at the armories in UBC, and they said, well, we've got some bad news. They're not going to train any more pilots this year, so we don't need any more Navy pilots. But if you want to hang around, you can wait and see if that changes in a couple of years. In the meantime, continue your training. Or we'd offer you an equally challenging career at sea. And so at this point, I'm starting to think the Navy's pretty good anyway. So from what I'd seen, I'd been on Oriole. You know, they brought Oriole over to Vancouver Harbor, and we'd been out in Oriole, and I'd been on a frigate coming to Victoria on a passage. And so it was pretty exciting. So I said, okay, yeah, let me put, we'd call the general officer's list in those days, which was a combination of different specialties, but basically you were going to go to sea and eventually command at sea. So that's the sort of education side of it. And I graduated from UBC with a Bachelor of Science in Physics and Math, and it was very useful in my specialty in the Navy as I went along. So I was quite happy with the education. And that program was extremely successful. In fact, my year and my year after at that program, three of us became admirals in the Canadian Navy. One Admiral Anderson, a full admiral. So I think it was a pretty valuable program for finding young people to join the military.
And you mentioned a lot of the reasons that you enlisted. Is there anything else you would add that was a motivation?
Well, that personal contact with the sailor, the family connection was pretty strong. And in those days, that was 1960, 61, 62, there seemed to be a Navy ship in Vancouver Harbor every weekend. Every time I looked off, I'd be down on the coast, down on the shore of North Vancouver, and you'd see one of these ships coming and going, and actually they weren't the old Second World War frigates. These were brand new destroyers being built in Vancouver. Well, that's part of it. They were being built in North Vancouver as well as Victoria and back east. And you'd see these beautiful looking ships taking off out of harbor, and there'd be a big rooster tail at the back, and everybody kept saying, you know, what amazing ships these new destroyers were. And so that even added to the excitement to say, this looks pretty good, you know. And the funny thing is, I had friends who were sea cadets and used to talk about the Navy all the time. And I was Boy Scout, and I never really had that contact. We didn't have Sea Scouts in North Vancouver in those days, so... Yeah, that was sort of an added thing, but certainly nothing from the family. In other words, no pressure to do this, and I didn't know any officers at that time. I just knew of these sort of contacts in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Just for clarification: what's a rooster tail?
A rooster tail. Now, if you go, if you have a speedboat and you put it at max speed, the propeller wash comes out of the water about maybe 20 or 30 feet behind the boat, right? In other words, all the turbulence, that it spills right up in a big splash. That's called a rooster tail. But to see a destroyer doing that, that was pretty impressive.
Very cool. So you talked about you considered the Air Force. Did you ever consider the Army at all, or was it mostly Navy?
Never even entered my mind, the Army. Although there were Army cadets, and Air cadets, and Sea cadets, and North Shore. The Army didn't have any sort of excitement for me. Yeah. Not to say that it wouldn't be, but we just didn't choose that route.
So what kind of training did you go through once you enlisted?
So the ROTP program was based on doing your year at university or military college, and then having a summer period of 3 months when you would go to your service and train. So I started my first summer when I left UBC for the year, I came over to Victoria and spent the summer here in Victoria. We did training packages down in Esquimalt and some of at Royal Road. So by then, Royal Road is empty because their students have all left as well, right? So, and that's where we started our basic seamanship training, where we spent basically over 10 weeks in classes and out on sailboats just to teach seamanship, but basically here in Victoria Harbour. And that was known as first summer training. And then the next year, I did second summer training, but by then I'd graduated from university. So I did my second summer here, same sort of thing, but more and more responsibility, more complex training in terms of communications and, you know, learning the Morse code, learning semaphore, learning navigation, learning basic engineering, learning basic firefighting, which I think you've probably in the news recently with the big fire protector. So all these things were the foundation of being a naval officer, and it was done in packages every year. Because I had then sort of got out of step, I was now graduating from university, but I hadn't done four summers of training. I then did the rest of the year in ships in Victoria, picking up the training package for the third summer and fourth summer. So by New Year's 1960, well, the fall of 62, January 63, I was in Halifax to start my what we call a pre-fleet training, which was more training to prepare you to go to sea and take on jobs in a ship at sea. So you would learn you had to do the financial side of being at sea, what ships had to do financially, and they had accounts, you know, they had canteens which were like little business stores in the ship, or there were pay requirements. And so all these branches we went through in the next 6 months in Halifax. We went through the supply branch, so we spent probably, well, maybe almost a month in supply training, and then we did an engineering training package, and then we did a communications training package and a navigation training package, so that by the end of that six-month pre-fleet course, which we call it, I was then posted to my first ship as a ship's officer rather than just a trainee on board, which was the case with the previous cases. You know, we'd be several self-cadets at that point. But by this time, I'm commissioned officer. And given my first ship was HFCS Saskatchewan, which wasn't even a year old when I went to. So talk about the excitement of, you know, seeing these new ships in Vancouver Harbour and then being posted to one as a junior officer, and another magnificent captain who was very, very committed to training officers, as well as doing the daily responsibility of being a responsible ship within a squadron of ships. But by happenstance, the ship Saskatchewan, when I left my course in June, 62, the ship Saskatchewan arrived in Halifax on a long deployment. And she actually had left Victoria in the spring of 62, gone down through the Panama Canal, stood by Haiti during one of the periods of unsettlement there, and then came to Halifax for some maintenance, and then was sent to England. So I hopped on board in Halifax, and off I was on my way to England. And I got back to Victoria in December of that year. So it was a great period of training offshore, lots, you know, learning how to do astronavigation by the stars, and learning, you know, all about replenishments at sea, and all the practical things that went on in ships, so that by the time I got back here in that actually was the time In fact, on our way home, we were to go into San Francisco Harbor for a 3-day break. It was arranged, and that was the day President Kennedy was assassinated. So we went alongside, fueled. The next morning, we left because the Americans were deeply in mourning, and it was not a time to be there, being in the way. So when we got back to Victoria, we then went through a series of period of maintenance because the ship had been away for the whole year, and we did maintenance training, and then we carried on doing normal ship's operations here in Victoria off the coast and back and forth to Hawaii and San Diego and up north a little bit, along the coast a little bit. We were in and out of many places up and down the coast. And by the spring of 65, I had finished my time in that ship and went to another ship here on the coast and stayed there until the summer of 65, when I moved back to Halifax to do a specialty course. This is my operations specialty course. Yeah.
Okay.
Which was almost a year long. So that's a little bit of training that I did.
Okay, just established, you mentioned that you went on HMCS Saskatchewan in 1962. How old were you when you were posted to the ship?
I, at that stage, 62, at this point, I'm 22 years old. I didn't say that one at the very beginning.
No worries, you want to let us know when your birth date is?
Yeah, 6 October 1940 was my birth date in Prince Albert. Yeah, so by then I was 22 years old. I'd finished my university and I'd finished my early training in the Navy.
Okay, and what postings did you hold after you were on HMCS Saskatchewan?
Well, I went from Saskatchewan to Halifax to do my operations course, which was a specialty course because in an operational ship you have, to have department heads, you have a supply officer, you have an engineer officer, mm-hmm. you have a weapons officer, you have all of these. So I had decided, I had requested that I go into operations. So I went through a year of operations training, and then that's now or 1966, I went to HMCS Nipigon as an operations officer. And I did that for about a year. And then after that, I went to HMCS Saguenay as an operations officer. And halfway through the commission, the captain left, and the ship's executive officer, who's second in command, moved as up to acting captain, and I was given the job as acting XO. So at, 24 years old, I was actually an XO destroyer out of Halifax. And then after I did that sort of series of time as an operations officer, I was given the opportunity to go into what in those days was basically software training, where the Navy was now building its next series of ships, known as the Tribals, and they were the first ones equipped with, big computer systems to control machinery systems and control weapons systems and the operation system. The interesting thing is that little recorder you've got in there probably has more storage in it than the computer we had on the ship that was as big as a refrigerator. And it had 70,000 bits of information. That was it. And we used machine language to program it. So as a when I was accepted into that program, I went down to the United States, to Dam Neck, Virginia, and did computer programmer training and systems analyst training down there, and came back from that and went to the Program Generation Center for the Iroquois class destroyers in Ottawa. That was actually it was supported by Litton Systems in those days. There were all the computers on the ships were Litton System computers, so they had the contract, and we went there. And we, the team that was put together in 1968, did all the programming of the data for the data system. So we're now at least three generations after that in the new in the tribal class destroyers they have now. Maybe four, but this was the early development of tactical data systems. So you could basically the web, right? You could send messages and send pictures and situation reports to other ships or to command headquarters, all of data links, and the data links were sort of spearheaded. I wouldn't say we led the way all the way, but we certainly Canada. Established a reputation as being one of the developers of data systems along with the Americans, and we brought in certain features that were unique to Canada. So it was an exciting time, and gave me a chance to spend some time with my family in Ottawa and learn about these ships. Then all of a sudden an opportunity came along to go to Halifax as an XO of HMCS Skeena, which I did with great gusto and great enthusiasm, and went off to be a part of an incredible team on board Skeena that spent early days with the NATO squadron out of Virginia. So it was sort of embarking on another part of my career. Big change from being a department head and going to be an XO, which I had passed. In those days we had command exams. After you've done your specialty courses and had some sea time, then you started studying for command. And the final part of that, after a series of exams, was a board where you sat in front of a board and they questioned you about how you would deal with certain command situations. And I was fortunate to get through that very early in my career, so then I was quote command qualified, and you had to become an XO. So I had actually had that qualification when I was acting XO for that period. So this period with Lit Systems was quite a challenging and exciting time. To know that eventually, as it turned out, I went on to command one of those ships of the systems that I had been designing, developing.
So what kind of systems existed before you started kind of designing the new one? Yeah. Well, how did it compare?
Yes, well, the best description I could give you is for the what we call the command displays. Mm-hmm. In an operations room, you'd have a command display. Mm-hmm. And in a ship, that display was based around the ship. You were in the center of that big mm-hmm. picture on this table that is like this dining room table we have here. It's got a plastic top on it. Mm-hmm. And the light, the picture would be portrayed from underneath onto the plotting table. So on this table here in front of us, we would see symbols representing ships, representing dangers, representing friendly ships, enemy ships, submarines, mm-hmm. and all of that data would be fed into a system that would then display it on a light table. That's basically what it was. It was a light table with manual inputs. Okay. And the other part of the light table was the paper that was put over the top of it. The plotters would plot positions of ships onto that as well. So you'd have the graticule, it was called, which is nothing more than a circular portrayal of the ships in the center of this graticule. And if there are other ships being plotted on it based on our radar input or our sonar input or a radio message from somebody saying, I see a submarine 6 miles from me on this bearing, you'd plot that on that piece of paper. And the graticule would move around that piece of paper underneath it as your ship moved. Okay? So all of this is now done by, was being done by hand. Operators, you've seen movies where the operators or the plotters are putting a plot of aircraft moving in on a place, and that's all done with what we call chinagraph pencils in those days, which nowadays you use, they're like a crayon pen. So all of that was now in 1970 being automated to the point where those other, let's say a submarine contact, was being fed, the information on that was being fed electronically into a computer that would then display that on a TV screen, if you want to call it a TV screen. It was a display, but it was a sometimes horizontal, but mostly vertical display. But there were no humans plotting it anymore. It was all being done by computers. And so that was a huge step away from a paper and a plotting table to basically computer displays. But it was slow in coming, and it took a lot of time because you had to be able to, each ship had to be able to talk to each other, mm-hmm. and aircraft talking, excuse me. So it was quite a big leap for technology within the Navy. And the Canadian Navy had some of the leaders in this, in World Navies.
Wow, yeah. Sounds incredible.
It was an exciting time, yeah.
Just moving to the your naval attaché career, when were you first approached about becoming a Canadian Forces attaché?
Well, let me say a little bit about the Navy's system. Every year we had an assessment mm-hmm. done on us by a superior. And on that assessment would be all your qualifications gained since your last assessment. It would include data about your family situation, data about courses you wanted to do. You wanted to do a certain mm-hmm. course. Some courses were sort of, there were specialty courses. There was a big blank about where you would like to go on your next posting mm-hmm. and what restrictions you would have. Like you might say, on my next posting, I would like to be posted to Victoria, and but my wife won't move with me because she's from Halifax and her family's from Halifax. Or it could be the other way around. She will, if I don't go, she's going to go anyways, or something like that. You know, so you could write that. And I used to, for many years, I'd go anywhere, anytime, mm-hmm. no restrictions. And then in 1976, the attaché's job in what was in Iran mm-hmm. came open. Mm-hmm. So I put on my personal evaluation report, it was called PER, I put on, I'd like to go as an attaché to Iran. And my superiors just sort of laughed and said, oh, I'll forward it anyways, you know, mm-hmm. go that way. And I never thought any more about it. I had just left my first command. I had command of helicopter destroyer Marguerite in Halifax. Mm-hmm. After 2 years, I went ashore to a headquarters. And I spent 1 year ashore, and then another opportunity to command one of the new destroyers, the Iroquois, mm-hmm. came up. So I went off to command that ship. And partway, that was a 2 year command I had there. Partway through that command, and during a deployment to, I think we were off Portugal or something, message came in saying we're considering offering George this opportunity to go as attaché in Japan. Would he like to do it? And as soon as I got hold of my wife, and she was said she was happy to do it. I said, yeah, I'd like to do it. So in 1979, I received an appointment to go to Japan, but preceded by a year's language training in Ottawa. So we moved from Halifax to Ottawa, and my wife and I did a year's Japanese language training. And just by coincidence, that was, I remember sitting in the language school going for lunch, and somebody turned the radio on, and what they were announcing was the Great Canadian Caper in Iran. You know, I thought, how funny this is, you know. Here I was wanting to go to Iran, and here they are all locked up or fleeing or whatever was going on there. So we did that language training, and I did some other training. And this is where I think I have to differentiate between the kind of, I would say there are two kinds of, well, there are two kinds of attaché jobs, basically. There's one that is really an intel gathering type of job, right? And then there's another one which is more representational than intel gathering. In other words, notwithstanding what you hear with these days about the CIA collecting information and everything, basically, if you went to a friendly country, you were there to represent your country whenever there was a need, whether for meetings or ceremonial things, compared to somebody that might have gone to Russia or the Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia in those days, who obviously spent time taking pictures. I mean, we all attachés did photo training, and we all were given cameras and told to use them as appropriate. But so the intel side was a big part of some attaché jobs. In Japan, it wasn't. They were termed a friendly. You know, they were friendly, and it was, we were there to represent the country in many ways. So we would occasionally go on a trip and take pictures. You know, just for. It wasn't anything secret about it or anything, but it maybe just a picture of some place where nobody had ever been. Like one of the things I wanted to do was go to a particular island called Sado Island, which is in the middle of the Sea of Japan. Nobody ever went there, nobody ever talked about it, but there happened to be a little army operation there. I always traveled with a colleague from a friendly country, the Aussie and I would team up and go to different places. The Aussie was an army officer and I was a naval officer, so we felt we could sort of fill in with if needed to make assessments or descriptions of Air Force stuff between the two of us, we could do it. But so we'd go off and go to Sado Island and understand how that featured in the defense of Japan, and to give our military back home a better understanding of the challenges for the defense of Japan and things like that. And, people used to ask me, well, what's happening to all this stuff you're sending back to Canada? And I sent a monthly report. And by and large, I think most of it, there would be a desk officer, they call him, you know, that would cover maybe the Pacific, and he would get these and look at it, and if there was anything he thought that was really something that, say, the staff should know about, there would be, you know, for example, if I reported a new class of ship was being developed and that was announced, and probably wouldn't make any news over here, but it would to our ship developers to say, oh gosh, they're using British equipment and American equipment on their ships, their new ships. So it would be common interest in some of the staffs about what was going on. But I think by and large, it was filed, and if anything ever happened, for example, the CDS came over. Minister of Defense came over once. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if somebody traveling like that wouldn't put together a pack for, they could refer to these packs and say, you know, here's some interesting things about that's been sort of reported by the attaché over the last couple of years, which would that would increase, you know, the visitor would have more to base his assessments on than just appearing there and not knowing anything about the country, you know, the country pack that he was being put together. So from that point of view, I think it was valuable that sort of reports be made, and I would have liked to have seen it more utilized on the commercial side, because when I looked around at my colleagues from other countries, a lot of them had a mandate, you get business for our companies, you know, whether it be gas turbines from the UK or airplanes from the States or whatever, you know, you build those relationships. And we in Canada actually had, we'd gone through a thing called the Hydrofoil Project. I don't know if you ever ran across that. Well, that's an interesting part of Canadian history. I was talking about data systems. The Hydrofoil Project was built back east, and if you ever go back there, somewhere on the Gulf of St. Lawrence, it's in a maritime museum. Mm-hmm. And if you Google Canadian Hydrofoil, you'll see a little bit about it. And it was forefront. I mean, hydrofoils back in the 1960s were really front-leading technology. And we had built one. And one of those data systems that I was telling you about that we were building for the Iroquois-class destroyers had already been built for this hydrofoil. And it, it set world speed records from Halifax to Bermuda to Virginia and had quite a big. So I use that as an example of Canadian leading technology, but it really didn't get much interest from the Japanese. They were building their own. They thought we did. And since then, as you know, there's quite a few hydrofoils around the world being used commercially. This was an attempt to use one militarily. But in the end, it was canceled because they ran out of money. Sort of like the Avro, you know. It was cost too much. Stop it. But in Canada, we're developing like our Aurora maritime patrol aircraft. Mm-hmm. We thought we had the lead in some of our systems there, and although we made mild attempts to interest the Japanese, we really didn't go out of our way to try and market them over there. Right? We sent them over once or twice, but really. The Canadian attachés didn't spend the time marketing things that other countries did. Now, the other side of it, some people argue, we don't want you over there marketing, we want you there representing Canada just from our interest, you know. So there's the other side of that coin, either way. But we had 29 countries representing attachés. Represented by attachés in Japan, and I would say probably half a dozen of them were sort of active in marketing. You know, it wasn't something they did all the time. So that's how I sort of ended up over there. And when I went there, the ambassador was Ambassador Rankin, who had been a naval officer in the Second World War, and was very keen about his knowing what was going on in the Navy, and so he was quite interested in my monthly reports or quarterly reports, however I filed them. And within the embassy, we attended the weekly staff meetings and participated in those, as well as organized different things. I remember I organized the first Terry Fox run. in Tokyo. I don't know if they still do it. I think they still do it, which was back in, I guess it was 81, 1981. In terms of my my wife and the kids, I had three boys by this time, and they're all at school, so moving them over there was quite a exciting time for them, and they actually went to a school, an international school called St. Mary's, which was actually run by Canadian brothers from Quebec. So it was, but there were something like 60 countries representing at that school. You know, it wasn't, there was an American school in Japan, but this one was a, quote, international school, so it tended to collect people from all over the world, the Aussies, and, countries that wouldn't have justification for establishing their own school there, because based on numbers, you know, but Americans should have so many Americans in Japan, they could have their own school. But the international school was a great experience for our family, and the contact with children from around the world. You know, the Vietnam War is over, but there's still people fleeing regimes, and they're ending up in the school there as adoptees. So it was quite an interesting thing for our children to see that and experience that. It was a challenge. I mean, my wife have had some language training, so I mean, she did her shopping in Japanese markets, so I mean, having Japanese was quite useful for her. And we'd find every once in a while ceremonial, if we invited somebody, if they knew that the wife didn't speak any language, any Japanese, they would probably not come. But if they knew that the wife was able to converse in Japanese, you were able to, they would come as a couple, for example. And that just opened up more doors when you had those opportunities, those occasions to meet people.
So when you were first appointed, did your wife get any training besides the language training? Or?
No, she didn't. No, she didn't. There was no other training for her. For the wives of the intel people, they did. But no, she did not. I was just trying to think whether there was an indoctrination day or something for maybe. But no, it really wasn't on the training program. I think she probably had a little briefing on medical and different things that might be appropriate in a foreign country. Mm-hmm. Like it was a 1 or 2 day session on living abroad. And I think it was Foreign Affairs actually gave us that lecture for that.
And when you first heard about the appointment, did you think it would have any effect on your career down the road? Or?
Well, I certainly know a lot of other people thought it was a bad move, because I was so excited about doing it. But other people said, oh, you should stay here, you should be doing these other things, you just commanded a ship, you should be doing this job in order to get ready for the next job. And at that stage, for personal reasons, we wanted a change. My wife had cancer, and she sort of, we'd gone through a couple of rough years, and this was an opportunity of our lifetime. And so we said, we're going to do this. The naysayers, I think, probably realized later that it opened up an opportunity that was incredible, because unlike most attachés, when I left my job there and came back home, I went on to command a squadron of ships here in Victoria. The majority of people leaving their job were going to retirement. So as a result of my time there, and when I came back, I made a strong plea to make sure we continued to do it with people that would be around for several years, mm-hmm. rather than losing them, losing their experience mm-hmm. coming back here. So in my particular case, it's amazing what happened, because I came back. One of your questions was, did I have any ship visits when I was attaché? And a lot of other attachés did. We didn't have any Canadian ships there in the 2 years that I was there, and I was there mm-hmm. too. But in the third year, there was a ship visit, but it was me bringing back a squadron of ships to Japan. In fact, we'd been to China as well, to Shanghai. But, I mean, that was the first indication to the Japanese that, you know, George just wasn't in contact with Japan for 2 years, being an attaché. Here he is again, mm-hmm. operational, coming back to you, and being involved for more than that one instance. I'd also been involved, I guess, maybe in at least maybe three Japanese ship visits when they came over this way. Mm-hmm. I would come out and be here and regain contact with them, and some of their officers I knew, you know. So then, after my job here as the squadron commander of that squadron of ships, I then went to Ottawa, where I did a desk job for a couple of years. They came back out to Victoria in 1987 as the Admiral Commander of Maritime mm-hmm. Forces Pacific, which then gave me continued contact with the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force. Not as much as it is today, because we do a lot more Pan-Pacific conferences and things. Then they were just early stages of saying this Pacific's going to be the future of Canada. But I went back from this job as the Admiral here to the job in Halifax, and in my first year in the job in Halifax, the Japanese Navy invited me to come back to Japan as the head of the Canadian Navy to meet their Navy chief and spend a week there with them, developing our relationship and exchanging ideas. So that relationship kept mm-hmm. building, you know what I mean? And then when I... head of the Japanese Armed Forces and Japanese Chief of Defense Staff visited General de Chastelin, who was our chief at the time, and we all met here in Victoria for dinner, and General de Chastelin asked me to do the welcoming speech in Japanese. So I kept coming back to these mm-hmm. folks, and I guess my last contact happened when I went to Belgium after being the Deputy Chief of Defense Staff in 1992. I went to Belgium as a military representative to NATO. And the first invitation I received was from SACEUR in Belgium to a dinner honoring the Chief of Defense Staff of the Japanese forces, who had specifically asked if I could be invited. So, I mean, that relationship that some people would say, well, it was for 2 years, right? Mm-hmm. But it says something about relationships with Japanese. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's long term. You don't do something fast. Mm-hmm. You build it slowly, slowly, slowly. And that was a typical example. My friends that I had known in Japan that were not military, we had our military attachés group that we mm-hmm. met regularly, which gave us a chance to meet with, you know, we had Russian attachés there. By and large, it was a good relationship. But I've just lost that train for a second, going from let's see. Well, in terms of my interactions with ordinary civilians in Japan, we made a point of joining a, well, they call it the Friendship Club there, which was a Japanese organization inviting diplomats and other foreigners to join in, to spend weekends together in various parts of Japan to learn some of the customs and traditions of Japanese, not the military side, but just to experience Japanese culture. And through that friendship, we got to know a young man that at that stage was in the Defense Department, but not in the military. I guess that is the, other than one other admiral that I knew from the Japanese forces that continued to hear from him, this civilian from the Defense Department went on to become the ambassador to Oman. And so that was a different, the other side of our relationship, getting to know the Japanese, and I continue contact with them to this day, as he's traveled from that back to Japan, and now he has a friendship society with the Omani society. I don't know how many there are in Japan, but I guess there's quite a few business people. So that was, I did get to know my neighbors. I lived in a Japanese neighborhood. I mean, we would say hello, but not get together socially or anything. And a lot of them didn't speak English, so we would be able to just say hello, and that was it. The interaction with other attachés, we did spend a lot of time together, as families, skiing together, traveling on weekends. It was a great country for going away for the weekend, some place that's staying in these little Japanese inns and learning the culture that way. And I've continued to have relationships, communications with a lot of those military attachés from that period. In terms of day-to-day activities in Japan, the Japanese military, or the, as they call them, self-defense forces, would make a point of taking the attachés out for certain tours to their bases. So we, over those 2 years, we would go two successive army tours where they would take you to big army exercises and army bases to see some of their equipment development. The Air Force did the same, and the Navy did the same. So all in all, that that would be three trips a year to some specific, well-organized for all attaché trips. Then, on top of that, whatever, like I mentioned, Sado Island, if a attaché wanted to visit a certain area or a certain activity, you'd put in a request to the Japanese, and they would have a look at it and look at the timing and decide whether they were willing to give you a tour. And that might involve traveling to Hokkaido or traveling to Okinawa. You know, it could be a fair thing. And but always as a pair. So I was the only attaché from Canada. I had a sergeant who was my administrator. But some countries would, like the Americans, would have three attachés at the start. They would have one for each service. And then sometimes a deputy, if there was a lot going on, maybe the Air Force doing big exercises or something. And the Australians would have two out of the three services. So there would be, there'd always be one missing of the three services. Canada, I had to cover all three services. So that meant I would be doing you know, more activities than say an American attaché or an Australian attaché. So we did these, we do these trips, and you always send a report back home to concerning the trip and things of interest that you saw or learned. We did get involved in lecturing at the defense colleges, although we did visit the defense colleges and on these, sometimes they would organize a tour to a defense college, especially if it was in town, it would be just a day trip, right, to that. And of course, the Japanese once a year would have a national day when they paraded all their military, and we went to that. And also the religious ceremonies. I quite enjoyed the religious ceremonies. They're basically based on Shinto belief, so it was always well organized and meaningful for them ceremony. There were periods, and even today now, what are we, 30, 40 years later, there's still controversy about attending certain ceremonies by politicians over there, and the Prime Minister recently was being chastised for attending a shrine in honor of warriors, in honor of the relationships with the Second World War. We were never involved in the controversial side of those things. The military attachés would go on block. There were protests by the West against a particular Shinto shrine because of the relationship in days past. So those kinds of events stuck in my mind in terms of the ceremony involved and the numbers of people participating in some of these would be thousands and thousands of people, especially in Tokyo on certain days, you know, big crowds. I did, as you know, we didn't, as an attaché, I would always be included in any ship visits of other countries that came. The French came, the British came, Americans would come, Australians would come. And that would be pretty simple, but it was still part of representing Canada over there, and the sort of things we do. And the other side that we would get quite involved with would be if there was a visit by a Japanese official to Canada. Particularly a military, if the chief defense or the head of the Navy was coming to Canada, or maybe even going to the United States but dropping into Vancouver on his way to someplace in the States, we would be invited to come and to talk to him about his visit, who he might hear from. Canada, we were always saying to them, why don't you have an attaché in Ottawa? They didn't have a Japanese attaché in Ottawa. They had a Japanese attaché in Washington, who was also accredited to Ottawa. So for say, a visit to England, the Japanese would contact their attaché in England and say, you know, we want to, so-and-so's coming, we need this and that. In our case, because there wasn't one here, occasionally I would be asked about a certain visit, you know. Either because the Washington fellow wasn't around or for any other reasons I didn't know. So there was that liaison in terms of helping them understand certain things about Canada. I would, as an attaché, occasionally get involved in business visits, especially if it's any connection to the military. Now, the Japanese had laws then, I think they've been relaxed a bit, about selling military equipment to anybody. It was forbidden for them to sell. Now, pair of binoculars is considered military equipment. And I remember one case where they had some great binoculars, and we were looking at binoculars from the Canadian Navy or something, and we sort of ran up against this wall. Well, we can't sell you the binoculars. You know, so, okay. Military equipment. But the reverse was not the case. I mean, we could sell them. Not that they bought a lot. They did eventually get involved with the helicopter hold-out system that Canada had invented and sold to the States and was trying to interest other countries in. They eventually bought a version of that, but it wasn't a direct link to Canada. I think it actually came through the States. But selling to them was... So if there was a company coming over involved, the attaché might get involved in that in terms of opening some doors if they wanted to open some doors. The other event that consumed a block of time was at that stage we had a National Defense College in Kingston that did an annual tour. And... Well, it did tours. If they were studying Europe, they all went to Europe for a week. If they were studying China, they all went to China for a week, you know. And so I guess I had two big tours, one each year, of the National Defense College students. So not only would you set up the tour for them of what they were going to go and see and do, but when they actually arrived, the commandant of the college would pay official calls on a number of dignitaries in Japan, and I would accompany him on that. The one time when our minister, when I was there and our minister came over, I accompanied him on calls to military places, nothing else. I don't think that was just basically help going with him for visits. I think that. So that those sort of link into roles at the Canadian Embassy, you know. In terms of being able to travel freely around Japan, there was never any restriction on my private travels or my business travels. My business travels were always approved by them because they wanted to go and see some particular military installation. But in terms of private visits and things I did on my own, I was never restricted in where I was going.
Okay, just to go back to kind of when you were first appointed as the attaché, what was your rank when you were first offered the position?
I was a Navy captain when I went over, and I was a Navy captain. Actually, I was promoted... In 1979, I was commanding Iroquois in Halifax, and I was promoted on leaving Iroquois to captain. And I did my Navy, my Japanese language training in Ottawa as a Navy captain, and then I went to Japan as a Navy captain, and I returned still as a Navy captain, which was the most common rank for attachés. We had one general from Mexico, and we had one commander, I think, from the Philippines. But by and large, most of us were Navy captains.
Okay. Yeah. And you mentioned your sons were school age, so how old were they when you went to Japan initially?
Yeah, and my oldest was 10 years old, and the youngest was... just turning six. Turning six, yeah. So they had the three boys that they had elementary school, basically. Yeah.
And did you have any previous experience with Japan before you went?
I had, in 1965, during my time here as a ship's officer, I went to Japan in 1965 for a first visit. Mm-hmm. That's fine. It had become quite common some of my colleagues had been there already because their summer training crews, they always had a summer training crew, either to Hawaii or San Francisco or both, and maybe to Japan. So there had been summer training visits to Japan. I wasn't on one. So the first time I got there, I was a young lieutenant in Mackenzie as a ship's officer. And, it happened so fast. And I guess there was a Canadian exposition there in 1965. Canadian exposition. Or they had a world exposition. Canada was there. But, I think that was my first trip. And, of course, that day, I was coincidence that the attaché there at that time was a Navy Commodore by the name of, while he was a Commodore, he was a captain by the name of Cogdon, and he was the attaché there, and he went on to become the defense liaison officer in London, England. That's his last posting. But his son was one of my ship's officers in Iroquois. And when I did that visit as the head of the Canadian Navy to Japan, I took along his son as one of my aides, which closed the link there rather nicely.
So I know that you mentioned that you were the only Canadian Forces attaché there, but how many civilian employees were attached to the embassy, roughly?
the embassy must have had... Well, I was under 30 there, but there were only two defense people there. You know, the warrant officer, or the petty officer, or he was an army vet, so he was a sergeant myself. The embassy was going through quite a change in terms of, it was an old embassy. It had, the ambassador's house was built in 1929. When we first put an ambassador in there, the Canadian government wouldn't build him a house, so he built it himself with his own money, and they finally embarrassed him so much they paid him off years later. So while I was there, there was toing and froing with the foreign affairs about building a new embassy or selling everything off and renting someplace. There was a lot of activity there at that stage to do with the future of the embassy, and it became a prize because we negotiated a pretty sweet deal with the developer without giving up title, and that was a big deal there. And I think there's a lot of activity in the auto pack, Japan, and trade development. So the trade part was quite active, and so I would say, because we were also allowed to have what they call locally engaged staff. So they were Japanese working in the Canadian embassy, and I think probably about 15 of them and 15 Canadians, that's about 30 in that whole organization there, working.
And what was your working relationship like with the civilian employees of the embassy?
We were made to feel quite at home, and we were one of them. You know, we had social activities together. Some of them had families that we did things together. So there was really no differentiation of whether you're military or non-military. I mean, it was made to feel at home and professional. We organized things like the Terry Fox Run, which involved everybody. It wasn't just for the military. And from that point of view, it was quite congenial, and never any difficulties, never any troubles with security or anything like that. It was quite quite comfortable relationship. Yeah.
And I know you mentioned trade on both sides, but how would you say that your duties compared with those of the civilian employees while you were there?
Well, yeah, they were totally different. But they were doing the same sort of thing. They were liaising with Japanese industry or Japanese foreign affairs. And it would go, if there was a visit of a minister, things got really busy. You know, the trade minister came, or certain other ministers would from time to time appear. It would get busy. We certainly all seemed to travel a little bit, travel a fair amount. Because of the time zone differences, you know, you wouldn't be hanging around for a phone call just the next day or something from Ottawa. Our communications network, we the military, depended on their communications network back home, you know. We didn't have a lot to do with there weren't any, like some embassies in Africa or something, you're worried about food shipments and different things like that. We didn't have any of those problems. It's a pretty easy place to live and safe. I mean, nobody from the embassy, either my staff or ambassador staff, had difficulties with the Japanese in terms of relationships or crime or anybody being beat up or anything. It never happened. You know, it's pretty well-behaved society. And in fact, my neighborhood that I lived in, as I told you, was a Japanese neighborhood. There was what was called a koban, which was a police box, block away. And that policeman knew everybody in every house in his region. So if there was a stranger, you know, he knew that person's not normally around here or something. So they were watched, but I never had anybody take anything, break into my house. Nobody would do that. In fact, one of my colleagues in another part of town was burglarized, and I don't know what was taken, but a whole bunch of stuff was taken. And of course, he reported to the koban, and it was all returned a couple of days later. Now, how do you even? What kind of society is that, eh? Wow. My wife and I, you know, we used the public transportation a lot. The train systems were just beautiful. I mean, it was so easy to get around. Nobody ever bothered us at night walking to or from the station. I mean, it was a very comfortable society that way. You wouldn't see drunks. Wouldn't see beggars. I'm just trying to think if I ever saw a beggar. I don't think I ever saw a beggar. No, it was a great experience for my family and for me. Developed a wonderful relationship with a large number of people. I think Canada benefited from having our presence in Japan, and I would have do it again if I had the chance, and I was 50 years younger, really. But it was quite a, and it's unfortunate that, and it's probably just the same today, we're always under the gun financially to close down embassies or reduce the number of people you have abroad. And why haven't we got people in Australia? You know, why don't we have ambassadors anymore? I mean, you could do a video conference call with whoever you want, you know. There will be continued pressure to reduce the number of attachés in our organization, that's part of, you know, when there's a 10% cut to middle personnel, then it's kind of hard to say you won't take a 10% cut in attachés, but it's our the loss will be ours in the end, you know. But I think they do a valuable, form a valuable role. There are many different representations abroad.
Still back, I know when you mentioned going to Sado Island with the Australian attaché, and you said that you were able to travel around pretty freely, but were there special places like Sado Island you had to obtain special permissions to go, or...?
Is there a... I think my wife could have gone on a bus and a ferry and gone to Sado Island.
Okay.
The reason we were... We asked to go there as we want. We wanted to travel and see the military mm-hmm. installations. So that would require... Now, whether... If the Korean asked for that, would they have said yes? I don't know. Would the Russian have got... I don't know. Nobody ever talked about it. But it's... There are certain areas that are sensitive in Japan mm-hmm. to have military roaming around. They probably exercise some... control over who goes inside the gates anyways. It's not saying that you couldn't jump in a car and go drive by, but you might not get inside the gate or whatever was there, you know?
Okay. I know you touched on a lot of them. Is there anything else you would add to the responsibilities of the Canadian attaché while you were in Japan?
Well, I never had them, but I had to do it. But ship visits was
mm-hmm.
ship visits or aircraft visits, because we were developing and sort of different. I mean, you know, our maritime air people. On that time, we were not Royal Canadian Air Force, Royal Canadian mm-hmm. Navy. We were in the Canadian Armed Forces, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, to have people from COMOX who are maritime. Air,
mm-hmm.
but their Air Force, that would mean that if they came to Canada, to Japan, over there, it's part of the Maritime Defense Force. They're part of the Navy, so that mm-hmm. would get me involved. Well, even if it was Air Force, I would get involved because as a Canadian mm-hmm. Force attaché. But so Air Force planes coming in on visits, I would get involved in.
Mm-hmm.
I would get involved in visits of if we had airplanes transiting en route, say it was a military mm-hmm. airplane wanted to go to Singapore or someplace that wanted to stop in Japan, I would be involved in clearances.
Mm-hmm.
If there was clearances denied, then certainly the attaché would be involved in saying, you know, why are we being denied, or
mm-hmm.
is it convenient or something. Just trying to think what else we would have done there. The military attachés from other countries had sort of a monthly meeting together. We would have lunch and discuss any issues that were coming up that way. Or if the Japanese wanted a certain message sort of sent to the attachés, we could do that at our meetings. So that was a little, I was a sort of the secretary of the association for 1 year, which was no big hassle, but I mean, you got to know everybody a little closer, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there were, once in a while, and then again, it was because of our not having a Japanese attaché sitting in Ottawa, I would be approached to say, could you find out something about something for us? Or would you inquire into this or that? And then I would send it to Ottawa. I did get involved. There were a couple of Japanese magazines. In a country that big, I guess, a population that big, they're going to be interested in things. So there are all sorts of Japanese magazines
mm-hmm.
that would decide to do a feature on the Canadian Navy or the Canadian Air Force or something.
Mm-hmm.
So you would get these calls, and then that would really be a case of setting up the liaison with the appropriate authorities back home in Canada. So from the magazine side, we did a little bit of work there. We never had, I mean, my American friend had the unfortunate experience of having to go and apologize to Japanese. So an American submarine collided with a Japanese fisherman and sunk a Japanese fish boat. So he was in it up to his ears for quite a while, going to explain what had happened, going to explain the inquiry, going to apologize to them for what had happened. I think. And the other thing that happened during my time was, of course, the Falklands War. Mm. And the Brit attaché there, and it's kind of interesting because he would feed me information that I would then feed back to Canada. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the Canadian in London was getting information he was feeding back to Canada. I don't know whether they always meshed or not, but that's sort of one activity. You act as a sort of conduit, sort of passing some information from time to time. Sometimes they're not happy incidents, sometimes they are. Mm-hmm. No? So I would say that was another little side of things. So is there any other thing that you think that we haven't covered?
Just a quick question. When you say they'd ask you, because there was no attaché in Ottawa, were they asking you questions related to military or general questions about Canada? Or?
It would only be basically military. I mean, if they wanted to know something about parks in Canada or you know, we've got a cultural officer there representing for Canada. So, you know, that's sort of parceled out. I would deal with the military things. We had cultural officers there. Either that or I would set up a meeting for them with our cultural officer rather than say, dump me. I would make sure that somehow they contact they wanted was gained. Yeah.
And I just wanted to ask, in your opinion, what was the importance of the role of the Canadian Forces Attaché in Japan?
I think what it was, and if you look at what's been going on in the Pacific since 19... let me get here. Yeah, the 80s, when you, if you go back and look at sort of Newsweek and Time, you'll talk about Pacific and the Pacific decade and how this is going to be so important. And maybe it hasn't happened as fast as some of these writers thought it would in terms of the importance of the Pacific, but it's still continuing to grow. And I think for Canada to have a presence in Japan in the military as well as our embassy, period. But if you're going to have an embassy, then you've got the full thing. When you've got military there as well, that's an opportunity to build relationships. And I think some countries, building relationships takes a long time. And I think the important thing that we've been able to do is build a relationship that's continued to grow and to grow. And was I necessarily the kingpin in that? No, I did my part at my time. But I was able to continue my part long after. And I think that recognizing the Pacific and all the things that are going to happen in the next 10 years, and our Arctic as well, and shipping lines and things, that it will continue to be a very important link to keep with the Japanese.
Yeah. Excellent. Is there anything else that you would like to discuss about this topic? Or in general?
No, I think we covered other postings I held. I mentioned the jobs I did afterwards there. And I think we Your questions covered the waterfront, as I say. But, certainly, a kind of relationship you had with the home country's liaisons. I mean, we were really well treated by all the liaison offices in the military, the Japanese military, and they were always open to discussions. And I was fortunate that one of my colleagues, in fact, he was the admiral in Halifax, Admiral Jimmy Wood. He had been at Royal College Defence Studies in London, along with the Japanese captain. And when I went to Japan, the first person I met in the liaison office of the Navy was this good friend from Halifax's connection, Jimmy Wood's friend, Imaizumi, who actually spoke English with a great British accent. It was kind of neat when you heard him speak. But yeah, there was. It's amazing how these linkages keep coming back, you know, and spreading. It's like a spider's web that keeps going on and on and on. And you lose one part, something else opens up somewhere else. So I think that's probably. Well, I would have to add to that. If you have any other questions, I mean, you could give me a shout, email, if you know if there's a blank or something that you want.
Okay. So this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Vice Admiral Robert George on March 10th, 2014. I'd like to thank you very much for agreeing and participating in the interview, Vice Admiral George. And just ask you to confirm that you have been provided with a copy of the interview release form prior to the interview.
I have done so, yes.
Excellent.
And today is the 10th, is it?
Yes.
There you go.
Oh, I think I took your paper, though.
Oh,
just one more thing.
I could make a copy of that if you want.
It's up to you for the copy. Yeah. Just one moment. So we've both signed the interview release form. Is that correct?
Yes, it is correct.
Thank you.